destruction which man has hitherto achieved in small ratio with gun and bomb, was exceeded many times by these powerful people. In considering the powers exercised by the Lemurians, Zeros put in, you have to remember the pliability of matter, unknown to your day. Moreover, although these people were not what you would call in a high state of industrial civilization, nevertheless they had power that you might envy. They had some degree of control over matter, mental control over atomic adhesion to which your materialists would never admit. Can you wonder that this degenerate civilization had to be destroyed because of the illicit expression of their knowledge, which was filtering back with their dawning intellect? Yet you may be sure that from the divine point of view nothing of value was lost. Millions of incarnations were cut short, but to deity death is not something to fear, it is release, promotion, a new phase of life and experience. All that was best in that continent was carried forward to a new existence by souls who remain true to their destiny. In the end, the unhappy land was riven by earthquakes and literally burnt out by volcanic action. Vast masses of land subsided during the lengthy period of this blasting of a continent, until eventually only pitiful remnants of a mighty race remained clinging desperately to mountain tops, which are now numbered among the new lands constituting the archipelagos between the land masses of Asia and Australia. Only the more advanced souls were inspired to emigrate, and under divine guidance these were led to new countries where it was intended that new light was to be fostered among indigenous inhabitants already forming the rudiments of a new civilization, one of the most famous in the history of the planet, the fabulous continent of Atlantis. Thus was consummated another fall of man. Already faded from earthly memory, it was a seeming triumph of evil over good, yet quiet reflection shows that it was otherwise in the eyes of a loving father. An immense amount of original sin must have been dissipated through the growth and the struggles of the Lemurian peoples and also in the trembling foundations of the erupting soil. Though this might be counted as a setback if one thinks in terms of time and the incidence of physical death and disruption of family life, in reality there was unbroken progress, for life went on in other realms. The clime was but translated to other spheres of influence. Nothing of enduring value was lost, and much of no value at all was destroyed. Thus it happens in the disappearance of all the great civilizations from the broad face of the earth. Destiny plays its part amid the grim enactments, and the supreme love of God ensures that everything works together for good. It is only in our limited understanding that we can see loss in the fall of empires. Such was the lesson to be learned from the rise and fall of that great community, the land of Lemuria. Chapter 9. Atlantis. Those islands of the blessed, so far away. So far Zeros had given me glimpses of those two races of mankind, so divergent in condition and with such a different destiny, the one to rise after a cataclysmic fall, the other to descend on a divine mission of rescue. He now informed me that we were to witness the final emergence of the two races during the famed civilization of Atlantis. In what we have already seen, he observed, you will have discerned the utter goodness of what you term God, in his wonderful handling of the battle between the power of good and the chimera of evil, to which the fallen race had given itself. Yet all was accomplished without ever invading the secure territory of man's free will, his most precious gift from his Creator. For it is within the sanctuary of that free will that the Spirit of God dwells, the kingdom of God in man. It is only in separation from God that man is cut off from his own spirit in some degree, and instead of seeing freedom as the wondrous attribute of Godhead, he sees it as some alluring figment in which God plays no part. He is enmeshed in his own delusions. God's battle is won before ever it is joined. For on the one hand there is omnipotence, and on the other delusion, only the veil of man's self-will is drawn between them. The battle is fought in the dimension of time, undimensionally it has no existence at all. It is as simple as that. It was a delicate operation which was undertaken in Atlantis. The descending race of Adamic peoples had spiritual power and some wisdom, but not great experience. The ascending race had experience latent in them but little spiritual expression. Now the two races were to meet and make an exchange, as it were, of their two attributes, from the one knowledge of how to live in the harsh conditions of incarnate life, and from the other how to express their own spiritual nature in all they experienced. On this vast continent we are about to visit, you will find the indigenous inhabitants, led to some extent by emigrants from Lemuria who had brought the fruits of that civilization with them, and among them there will be the incarnating race from the Adamic realms, the Garden Beautiful. It will not be easy for your understanding to imagine a whole environment being lowered, like a scene in a theatrical production, into contact with a much more material environment, yet such was the case. Of course, this transition took millions of years to complete, and its manifestation would not have been visible to human sight. Perhaps the manifestation of human birth would be a good simile, for it was not accomplished without labor and was fraught with danger to the Adamic race. While the inhabitants of the Garden Beautiful were in their natural realm, nothing was hid from their eager questing minds, just as nothing had been hid from those spiritual beings who fell from grace. God hides nothing, but a growing intelligence is not able to assimilate all it encounters. The finite cannot encompass the infinite, yet all is there, awaiting a readiness to understand, a breadth of mind to conceive the undimensional perspective that the Creator employs. Ignorance holds no place in God's purpose, but just as your infants cannot absorb what is clear to the mature students, so the souls which are younger in experience cannot absorb the greater truths. So the instruction has to be given on a lower level, made more simple, and where it is enshrined in love there can be few minds which cannot grasp the fundamentals of spiritual life, just as you have them in your Christian ethics. They are not new, for truth is ageless. Nevertheless, the true Atlanteans, the Adamic people, were accustomed to fourth-dimensional truths, yet they had to try and lower these into three-dimensional teaching for the benefit of the worldly-minded from the fallen race. The Adamic people were spiritually alert but were not skilled in manual dexterity like their darker neighbors, so it was they who provided the inspiration for the buildings and other forms of cultural expression, while the tribesmen provided the labor, glad to serve these lovely beings who were to them in the nature of gods. Slowly the great civilization was built up under the aegis of those who had brought with them the memory of their pristine life in the Garden Beautiful. In return, the indigenous inhabitants became their servants and tillers of the soil. Just as in the Garden Beautiful celestial visitors used to manifest at the temples and guide the instruction, and these points of spiritual contact became seats of learning in matters long denied to our three-dimensional understanding. Despite their protests, images of these visitors were placed in the temples and elsewhere, and became focal points for psychic power, just as in the olden days of Lemuria. The Adamic people were a race of astrologers, taking the subject on a far higher and more spiritual level than we do. They knew something of the cosmic rays and interplanetary influences, and they knew how to blend and control these influences at the right season to benefit the crops. And they had some control over the atomic nature of matter. Some of your priests still bless the crops today, but that is supplication and not control. But, I put in, how is it that all record of such powers has been lost? Surely some knowledge of such incredible powers would have filtered through. You must remember what immense periods of time we are dealing with. Also, there was little writing at that time, except by the gifted few. There was little need for it because a permanent source of knowledge existed in the celestial visitors during their frequent appearances. Imagine that you had an atomic war that was worldwide and it destroyed most of your records, and then suppose that 20,000 years later, when a new kind of civilization had been built up, that scientists began to unearth the prehistory of your day. What would they find of your knowledge from the fragments of your contemporary history dug up from the ruins? How would they assess the thinking of your day? How much would be ascribed to folklore and legend? To you, Atlantis is but a lovely memory, most inadequately authenticated. In the most unlikely places in widely separated parts of the world you will find references to it, such as the Land of the Blessed, or the Golden Age. And thus it was, for it held men and women of great beauty of form and character, radiating divine love in a way that your intellectuals would find unacceptable. It represents the nearest approach to an earthly heaven that it is possible to produce in material form. Yet, as you shall see, even these lovely people had to pay the price of their service, in that they too came to choose self instead of God until in the end they perished in the most degrading infamy the world has ever known. By this time I was quite accustomed to the sudden changes in dimension essential to timeless exploration. Accustomed as I was to wondrous visions, on opening my eyes I was quite unprepared for the scene that I surveyed, my first glimpse of the lovely land of Atlantis. In previous experiences I had encountered that difficulty of focus that I have mentioned. But here, in this lovely landscape, I found the clarity of vision that amazed me. In this gloriously warm sunshine and freshness was surely the land of our dreams, indeed a golden environment. Wide spaces and fertile plains showed how everything had crystallized into a new and sun-washed definition. We were standing on the slopes of a hill looking out over a plain, which was watered by several rivers. I felt a thrill as I located a number of small villages here and there amid patches of cultivation. I longed to set out and investigate, but something held me to this hillside, savoring the warm scented beauty spread out before us. I felt so good that I told Zeros that I could have here the strength of two men. He smiled at my enthusiasm. I am glad you sense the inherent beauty of this land, which God had prepared for his children to live in and learn to know of his love for them, but alas! However, we will not spoil this first glimpse. Come, let us travel and see more of it. With my hand held firmly in his, we traveled at our accustomed swift pace over the intervening country until we came to the first of the villages. This was composed of wattle huts of quite a large size, very cleverly made. When I saw my first Atlantean, I knew why. He must have been 7 or 8 feet tall, dark in skin, for he was one of the tribesmen who tilled the land. His skull was low and sloping with a broad projecting chin, and he wore a longish beard and hair. His clothing consisted of a loincloth. He walked erect and with an air of confidence that contrasted well with the uncertain movements of his ancestors. He entered a hut and so we turned to where some children were playing, in the way that children of all ages have played. They at least, I mused, have not changed much. Then we perceived a little group approaching along a track. First came a man, like the other, of considerable stature, leading an animal harnessed to a sledge. It was something like our llama but larger and coarser. The use of a sledge showed that these people had not yet learned the use of the wheel. Seated on the sledge were two women in bright clothes, surrounded by a number of bundles. The women were dark-skinned like the men but with smaller features and bright, eager eyes. One was wearing earrings that might have been of gold, the other held a babe at her breast. Other children played about the sledge, dropping behind and then running to catch up. It was a pleasant domestic scene. Once the man turned his head sharply as if he heard some untoward sound from the adjacent forest and peremptorily called the children to him. Evidently, I thought, this smiling land is not without its stings. The abounding forests must harbor dangerous beasts, while no doubt there were poisonous reptiles among the luxuriant vegetation. Gorgeous plumaged birds there were in plenty, while once or twice we heard deep snarling sounds from the depths of the forest, but we did not see any beasts. As we moved on swiftly over hill and dale, the forest land gradually gave way to open grassland, with frequent patches of cultivation. Then presently, with a thrill, I caught the glint of sunshine sparkling with reflected glory from some buildings on the horizon. These I soon found came from the domes and minarets of a city, and Zeros intimated that here was indeed none other than the famous city of the Golden Gates, that dreamlike city that has graced a thousand tales and legends. This prehistoric city, enshrined in the mists of antiquity, has lived so long in our unconscious memory that it still influences our dreams of a golden age when men knew not war and lived in harmony with their surroundings. Poets wrote of it and singers clothed it with a desperate longing, an age when love ruled. It still dwells in the background of our ideals, coloring our pageantry, the pattern of our castles in the air, our dreams of utopia. I looked eagerly for the three legendary peaks. Yes, there they were. Behind the city, the center one crowned with a temple that seemed to be of solid gold. Its domes were covered with gold leaf shining with that unmistakable reddish tint that betokens the precious metal. The walls were of a pinkish stone that served to enhance the glory of the glittering roofs. Down from the center hill cascaded clear waters from some hidden spring at the summit and, as I afterwards discovered, these served to feed a system of canals that provided traffic routes for the city. We stopped on the lower slopes of this hill and I saw that the city was divided into districts by these canals which encircled it three times before being drawn off by a channel to the sea. In the center were the larger buildings, probably minor temples and offices of importance, while in the next area were residential quarters. Beyond the second circuit of the canal system were obviously business houses, for here were many barges of rough timber tied up to wharves. Beyond again were small huts or shacks in which no doubt the tribesmen who served the city, lived with their families. After a while we descended into the city, entering it by one of the immense golden gates of legendary fame, only at this period they were only gateways, the need for the protection of gates had not yet arisen. As we passed through the gateway we were faced with a magnificent vista of a broad avenue that indicated a high degree of civic planning. This then was the great capital of Atlantis, that in some form or another was to last many thousands of years, with a long and checkered history. As we traversed the city I saw no signs of mean side streets or dark alleys that hover behind the fair avenues of our modern cities. Though there was wide contrast of palace and humble dwelling it was clear that there was no intolerable division of rich consequence and utter degradation with which we are so hauntingly familiar. It was high noon when we entered the avenue and probably the hour of siesta for there were few people about. But some were obviously of the Adamic race. These were fine in the extreme, in strong contrast to the tribesmen, their clear white skin unmarked by strain or labor. Their eyes were blue and of a piercing keenness as if to indicate the intelligence and strange powers of their owners. Most were dressed in gay colors in draped robes. Naturally we had no means of intercourse with any of these people nor they any knowledge of our presence, we were separated by an immense dimension of time. In expansive mood, as if he were enjoying a return to a scene he had once known, Zeros seated himself on a stone bench beside the road in the shade of a large tree, and I joined him. At our feet strutted pigeons, for all the world as if they had alighted there from Trafalgar Square. You see, he said, gazing unseeingly at the pigeons, this descending race had to leave behind much of the glory of their real being when they descended from the Garden Beautiful. What you see of them here gives no idea of their erstwhile beauty or culture. And you must not blame either of the two races for the fall of this wonderful civilization, it had to be, for the good of mankind as a whole. It was a difficult situation, and fraught with danger as the lower race began to evolve. How did they worship at this time? I asked. The sun was always the focus of worship on Atlantis, through the visible glory of the sun the people, especially the tribesmen, were able to visualize the supernal glory of it which they could not see. They could feel the warmth of spirit through the rays that vitalized their bodies, for here, you understand, the atmosphere was not yet vitiated by evil emanation as it became in later times. The Adamic people gave to the fallen race the message of love that was inherent in them from their own Eden. They taught of the love and beauty that they knew, of their unity of being and of the Father-Mother God whom they revered. And they demonstrated their psychic powers with an adept manipulation which the tribesmen regarded as magic. On the other hand the tribesmen had something to offer the superior race, they had experience of good and evil, right and wrong, bought dearly through close contact, an experience of some value to beings who had known only the good, with no contrast to show the difference. Our conversation was broken by a disturbance further down the street. There was some singing and shouting in the distance, and as the sounds drew nearer I could see that a crowd of people was advancing, mostly of the darker race. At their head strode a figure, striking in appearance, a head taller than most. He was dressed in a robe of azure blue edged with silver, while on his head he wore a fillet of gold fronted with some emblem I could not distinguish at the distance, and on his breast there was a large gem that sparkled as he walked. He radiated vitality that I could feel even where I stood, and he seemed the very embodiment of spiritual strength and grace. Zeros, too, stood in respect, and as the stranger passed threw out his arms in glad salutation, and immediately the visitor turned his head and a lovely smile of recognition lit up his features, his eyes shining with love and joy. It was a thrilling moment, for such was the understanding between these two that they had been able to bridge the gap of thousands of years that divided them, destroying the illusion of time in one blinding moment of truth. Even I got caught up in that shattering moment, for the royal figure glanced at me and his keen gaze searched my very soul. Then he smiled at me too, and his eyes filled with an eloquence I can scarcely describe. Can man love man? If so, then I loved this man, this stranger who was strangely known to me, a part of my life, geared with me to the wheel of events. Before I could recover my sense of time, he was gone, with a crowd of jostling, admiring followers in his wake. With all my heart I longed to join them. The voice of Zeros broke in. That was one of the great leaders and teachers of Atlantean times, he observed. I cannot give you his name in eternity, and his name in time has been lost to posterity, though it was perpetuated in the later pantheon of so-called gods, those travesties of the Shining Ones who were held to have disported themselves with human antics on Mount Olympus. But as you have seen, they were beings of very real beauty and power, never wholly incarnate, yet living amongst the people they had come to aid. I begged for further information about the kings of Atlantis, but Zeros had little to say about these. If I were to tell you of Melkarth Hercules, twin rulers of Atlantis, whose deification was later commemorated by the twin pillars of bronze in the temples of Western Europe dedicated to them, you would try and trace their dynastic era, only to find disillusion. You cannot connect these great beings, more ethereal than physical, with your conception of kings and priesthood, any more than you can connect the Neptune, with his antics on crossing the line, with that great king of Atlantis who once ruled from the Golden Temple in this city of the Golden Gates. The realities were neither physical kings nor mythical deities, so you will have to be content with that. As he spoke, there was a sudden vibration beneath our feet. I looked up and felt, rather than heard, a distant rumble travel round the hills. Thunder? I echoed. But an instant later the supposition was lost in a thunder and a roar the like of which I had never heard. A few people screamed, while the birds rose in perturbed flight, squawking their fears. Once more the ground heaved, thunderous noises smothering all others. Even Zeros looked momentarily alarmed. The earthquake passed as suddenly as it came. There seemed little trace of damage, no doubt because of the still plastic nature of the crust which enabled the shocks to be absorbed. Soon after, twilight descended, and to my surprise the city remained aglow. The light came from high pylons which I had noticed, at the top of which was a glowing light, which Zeros informed me was atomic in nature, generated by a process lost to us. Then he led the way into a compound in the center of which was a house, somewhat like a Roman villa in design. It was a two-storied residence, surrounded by verandas. In one of these a family sat at a meal. With some trepidation I drew nearer, until I remembered that our presence held no relation to the susceptibilities of these people. They were white Atlanteans, two women, a man and two children. The wooden bowls they used seemed rather clumsy to my notion, but otherwise it might have been a family party gathered in some colonial bungalow of our time. Dark-skinned servants waited and handed round the dishes, while the family sat on low stools and ate with their fingers. The dishes held what appeared to be curds and honey, while a great dish of fruit occupied the center of the table. One servant brought in a jug of sparkling liquid which he poured into wooden mugs. There appeared to be no distinction between employer and servant, no sign of servitude. It seemed that each race was conscious of the advantages of their mutual association. I would not, however, like to maintain that the Atlantean society of this period differed little from our own contemporary society. For one thing, there was an air of unsophistication, a lack of assurance, that characterized these people, as if they found their environment difficult with no traditions to fall back upon. Life in the Garden Beautiful must have unrolled for them like the pattern on the nursery carpet does for our children, nothing to fear, only to enjoy. But now they had to build their own traditions without any deep experience to aid them in molding their lives. They had only their spiritual strength to fall back upon. It was a poignant thought that these lovely innocent people were destined to succumb to the evil, inherent but not yet manifest, in the very soil they trod. Zeros explained that the rhythmic ebb and flow of the spiritual power that manifests the universe brought them succeeding waves of spiritual strength, which ebbed away so that they might be led to depend upon its return flow. Such too is life in our day, when exaltation so often is followed by depression, though naturally to a less extent than these people experienced. Such was the condition of the two races which were meeting and merging in this lovely land. As the young men of the fair race grew in vigor, they were looked upon by the adoring daughters of the tribesmen, and many succumbed to the age-old urge of humankind. And so began that fatal admixture of the two races, the one divine and ethereal, the other so coarsened that intelligence was dimmed, that was to have such dire results for the greatest civilization this world has ever known. Perhaps it had to be, being part of the testing of the spirit of both races, part of a great plan of rehabilitation for the fallen race of man. Zeros and I paid many visits to this rare and wonderful city at varying stages in its history, which has been calculated to have lasted over 750,000 years, in one form or another. Its story is like that of a man, born in innocence, growing in stature and knowledge, faced with the temptation of self-indulgence and ambition, put to the test at every point in his progress, until at last he lays down his material body, his mission completed. Its gradual decline and the catastrophic ending of the whole continent was due to the emergence into manifestation of the latent evil created by the fallen race, so that it could be objectified and thus transmuted. As Zeros put it, God does not make mistakes, with him all things work together for good. If you break his laws, he immediately sets forces to work to rectify your mistakes. He does not interfere with your free will, for that is essential to your progress. Instead, he projects his divine love in such power that it bums out the dross in the offender and his environment. Thus there is suffering. Quite clearly, the golden temple on the three-pronged hill behind the city was the dominating factor in its life, and almost certainly the source of its spiritual power. In the earliest, almost ethereal conditions in which it was created, so wholly were the vibrations manifested that it was almost etheric in nature, and only initiates were allowed within its precincts. There was a wall of etheric power surrounding it which only an adept could pass. But when Zeros and I first saw it, the actual temple was in the form of a cross surrounded by circular gardens, thus epitomizing the sign manual of the earth, the cross of sacrifice within the circle of redemption. The cross was formed by four great halls branching off from the central dome, so vast that St. Paul's Cathedral could easily be contained within it. As there were no corrosive elements in that clear atmosphere and matter was not so dense and cohesive as it is today, buildings of this description lasted for incredible periods of time. Exteriorly, the temple was exquisitely designed, with the central dome covered with gold of a redness unknown to our geologists, and with an array of slender spires that were covered with silver, seeming to stretch like fingers adoringly into the azure sky. The main approach was from the east, up cascading flights of steps, punctuated by level platforms on which were flanking statues and sculptured designs of mystic interpretation. Before the main entrance was a broad open hall of pillars, with a floor of wondrously designed mosaic, while fountains played unceasingly to add to the cool comfort of the shade after the heat of the sun-drenched exterior. Feeling like pygmies, we made our way into the interior. The high priests were, at this period, also the kings of the Atlantean Empire, so it had a temporal as well as a spiritual character. Zeros explained that the first Great Hall was the one devoted to governmental affairs. It was without windows, being lit by the same method as used on the pylons in the city.